Yeah, I know.
All right, we're going back on the record.
Hadn't get my mic on. Thank you. We'll go back on the record in the hearing today. I'll be presiding today. Dr. Opozian remains on the witness stand. And I understand we have the intercall operator, so our folks at home can hear us. We're all set with that. All right, Dr. Opozian, I'll remind you, you're still under oath, and you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Special Masters. Good morning, Dr. Opozian.
Good morning.
I want to continue asking you about the report that you filed in this case. Do you have that with you?
I don't have it with me.
We'll give you a copy.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, Dr. Opozian, it's unclear from your report whether it's the ethyl mercury in the thimerosal-containing vaccines or if it's the resulting inorganic mercury that causes autism. Which one are you causally implicating?
Thimerosal is in the vaccine that is injected into a child. All the scientific literature indicates the thimerosal is quickly converted to ethyl mercury. The ethyl mercury is then quickly distributed to the tissues, crosses the blood-brain barrier, gets the brain, and there it is de-ethylated to mercuric mercury. That is the metabolism of the metabolic route of what happens once you give thimerosal. Now, whether it's thimerosal per se or ethyl mercury per se that you're asking a question about, I'd ask you to be a little more specific in your question.
I'm asking you, it's your opinion that thimerosal-containing vaccines are causally related to autism. Is that correct?
That is my opinion, yes.
And I'm asking you whether it is the ethyl mercury component or the inorganic mercury component, once the ethyl mercury deethylates, that is the cause of autism.
I don't think ethyl mercury per se stays in the brain long enough to have an effect that we have yet measured. I think it is the mercuric mercury that is the culprit. And it's the mercuric mercury that remains in the brain almost forever and has very definite toxic effects in the brain.
And what's the basis for your conclusion that the mercuric mercury has toxic effects in the brain?
The scientific literature. If you read the scientific... I mean, I quoted a paper in which they injected mercuric mercury directly into the brain. Can we go, perhaps go, let's go back to that, actually. If you have copies of those slides, I don't have, you have copies of my slides? You were given a sheet yesterday with the copies.
What slide are you referring to?
Pardon?
What slide are you referring to?
Well, I'd like to see the copy so I can give you a number.
Oh, you don't have the slides with you.
If you give me a minute, I'll bring it up on my computer. I certainly do have the slides. Sunday, final quotes. Here they are. And let's see. Thank you.
Doctor, you know...
Gallagher, slide number 68. I'm sorry, I'm slow. There are many slides.
I'm sorry, Dr. Apoposian. Which slide number did you say that was?
Slide number 68.
68, and this is on petitioner's...
68.
This is on petitioner's trial exhibit 2.
Paper entitled Gallagher et al. Identity of ultrastructural effects of mercuric chloride and methylmercury after intracerebral injection. So among other things, they injected directly into the brain mercuric chloride, and found, thus in spite of their distinctive clinical syndromes, these two classes of mercury compounds, namely mercuric chloride and methylmercury, are capable of inducing neuronal necrosis.
And that's the basis for your opinion that inorganic mercury causes autism?
I don't think that was the question you originally asked me. You asked me, what is the evidence that mercuric chloride does damage the brain?
I asked that question. I also asked the basis for your opinion that the mercuric chloride is causally related to autism.
In my scientific opinion, it does.
What is the basis for your
opinion? Based on papers like this and a vast variety of evidence that indicates that the mercuric ion has a high affinity for sulfhydryl groups and will tie up the active centers of enzymes not only in the tissues but in the brain as well and inhibit those enzymes. The thyroredoxin system, which was maybe slide 10 or 11, if we want to go back to that.
No, that's fine.
Is it necessary?
No, thank you.
Okay, it's a good indication. The latest paper of nanomolar amounts of mercury, of mercuric chloride, nanomolar amounts, those are very small amounts, those concentrations, are inhibiting this purified thyroid redoxin system.
And that's so, that's an in vitro study. I mean, an in vitro study, correct?
That's an in vitro study, but it's an in vitro study in which we don't have to worry about competing enzyme reactions. We don't have to worry about the breakdown of substances or the formation of inhibitory substances for other reactions. It's a very purified DNA recombinant synthesized enzyme. It's the purest kind of system that you can find in biochemistry.
And from that in vitro study, you conclude that inorganic mercury from thimerosal...
I can't hear you.
And from that in vitro study...
Yes.
You conclude that thimerosal-containing vaccines, the inorganic mercury, causes autism?
But that's not what you asked me originally on that study. What I'm saying is there is a body of information, published information, that indicates that mercuric ion has a high susceptibility, a great affinity for the active centers of essential enzymes. And if those enzymes are inhibited, you're going to have problems.
And how does that cause autism?
Well, since in the brain, there are the centers, actually the control of movements, there are the controls of thought. The brain controls our body and everything that we do about it. And once you begin inhibiting critical enzymes, inhibiting critical proteins in the brain with an inhibitor such as mercuric chloride, you are going to have problems. There's no question we all have a certain amount of mercuric chloride in our brains, but I think, and I have, let me think one more. Yeah, I think if you look at the autopsy data, you'll find that mercuric chloride remains in the brains of those autistic children.
Doctor, is it your opinion that all forms of mercury exposure, both prenatal and postnatal, lead to autism, cause autism?
Perhaps we can go back to, let's go on to another slide.
And Doctor, I'm assuming what you have on your computer is the slide. Is
there
your testimony
the
from the
if you have a copy, it'd be much easier for me to thin through them. I put them in my suitcase, which is back the
hotel. I only have my one copy
today.
I'm
but
sorry.
Anyway, let me, so you don't see this either. Anyway, there is a diagram in the slides that were handed out to you anyway, showing that ethylmercury, that thimerosal is converted to ethylmercury, and through a various kinds of metabolism, it ends up in the brain causing encephalopathy, causes autism. Yes, I think ethyl mercury is metabolized to mercuric mercury, and thank you very much. And ethyl mercury and mercuric chloride, mercuric ion itself, are very harmful to the brain.
Oh, so it's both the ethyl mercury and the mercuric chloride and the mercuric?
The ethyl mercury is going to be there for a short period of time.
Does that do any damage?
Pardon?
Does the ethyl mercury do any damage that contributes or causes autism? Just the ethyl mercury?
The ethyl mercury is the source of the mercuric ion that resides in the brain after ethyl mercury has been metabolized in the brain. And it is the mercuric mercury that remains in the brain and probably has the long-term effect. I think the scientific literature, a great deal of it, supports that hypothesis.
Okay, my next question was then, do you think it's both prenatal exposures to mercury and postnatal exposure to mercury that cause autism?
I think it depends on the individual. It depends on what the diagnosis is going to be. I think as many people, I think one of the best people that I know of is Professor Ellen Silbigeld at Hopkins, who got the MacArthur Award, the Genius Award. The only toxicologist, male or female, who's ever gotten that award, told me quite some time ago that, in her opinion, the thimerosal and ethyl mercury will trigger a response. There is already in a pregnant woman, mercuric mercury to some extent, and methyl mercury to some extent. And there is no such thing that we know of as a mercury-free human being. And so there can be an effect prenatally, there can be effect postnatally. It's going to depend on the concentration and the species of mercury that you're talking about. Is that an answer to your question? Is that suitable?
What kind of mercury are in utero infants normally exposed to? What species?
The in utero infant, as you call her or him, is exposed to what the mother has been exposed to. The mother may have been exposed to methylmercury from the fish that she ate, and that methylmercury and various forms of it can be stored in the woman's body. The recommendation that many of us have, and the recommendation I think that many countries now have, Sweden, Norway, and we're trying to get it through the FDA in this country at the present time, is that women of childbearing age and pregnant women should not eat fish that contain a great deal of methylmercury. So one source of the mercury in that infant would be the methylmercury that comes from the mother. Another source of mercury in that infant in utero would be the mercury that comes from any amalgams that she may have in her mouth. The third source, of course, would be if the mother has had a vaccination of some kind. I don't remember which vaccine it is, but certainly some women do get a vaccine sometimes during pregnancy, or if not before. And this mercury is stored in a woman's body. And so when the child, when conception occurs, and during the maturation of the embryo, there is mercury passing from the mother in the blood to the infant. Three possibilities of our sources. One is fish, second is amalgam, and third is vaccination.
So does the methylmercury consumed by the mother and passed on to the infant, does that contribute to autism?
You're asking whether methylmercury contributes
prenatal
to autism?
Prenatal exposure to methylmercury. Or prenatal exposure to the mercury.
Could you talk in the microphone, please?
I'm asking if the prenatal exposures to mercury, you said methylmercury through fish consumption, through dental amalgams, do those contribute or cause autism, that prenatal exposure?
I said that an infant in utero would be exposed to the mercury that's in the mother. The mercury in the mother could come from fish, amalgams or vaccinations.
I understand that, but does it cause or contribute to the autism? If the child develops autism, can you look back to the methylmercury exposures and prenatal exposures?
It would be very reasonable to believe, as some of us do, that the methylmercury in the mother will eventually be converted in the child's brain to will eventually some of that methylmercury will get into the child's brain. And through these various sources, when the child is born and in early childhood, there will be an accumulation of mercury in that child. And there is a prevailing thought by many that many people have that the vaccines could be the trigger, what pushes the toxicity of the mercury over the threshold to cause autism. That is one of the theories.
So is it your opinion that the exposure to methylmercury can cause autism?
Again, we're getting into terms that you've got to be more specific about. The child is exposed to thimerosal. The thimerosal is metabolized to ethylmercury. One might say, as far as the true definition of exposure, the child is not exposed to ethylmercury. The child has thimerosal converted to ethylmercury in the body. And that ethylmercury then travels to the brain and to other tissues and is deethylated to give mercuric mercury. So if you ask me, is a child exposed to ethylmercury, I would say we're dealing with semantics.
You know, it might be helpful if we put up the chart that you had up yesterday about different routes, different exposures to mercury.
Is this the one that you want?
And we are on.
So here we have what slide
that is. I'm sorry, it is slide 23.
Okay, slide 23 on Petitioner's Trial Exhibit 2.
It's entitled Influence of the Mother and Other Sources for Mercury Exposure of Infants. Is that the one you want?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
My name's Ms. Renzi, Linda Renzi. Linda Renzi.
Thank you. Thank
sure.
you. Ma'am.
Now, Dr. Poshian, from your chart and from your testimony yesterday, we get methylmercury from the mother through fish consumption, through chicken consumption, and we get inorganic mercury from dental amalgams, and then if the mother has had a thimerosal-containing vaccine, the child is exposed to ethylmercury. The mother. Is that correct? So in utero, the child would be exposed to methylmercury from fish, chicken, inorganic from amalgams.
Yes.
And if the mother has a vaccine, ethylmercury.
Yes. If the mother has vaccine, yes, ethylmercury, yes.
And postnatally, the child's exposed to methylmercury from breast milk, methylmercury from fish consumption, methylmercury from chicken. Dental amalgams, I guess, if the child would be old enough to have fillings.
Or from the mother.
And then thimerosal-containing vaccines. Now, what is the basis for your opinion, given all the methylmercury exposure that the child has both in utero and postnatally, that it's a vaccine, 12.5 micrograms of ethylmercury, that trigger that child to have autism?
Well, it also could be 187.5 micrograms of mercury. That is what the child gets after a set of vaccinations. So there's a big difference from 187 as compared to 12.5. However, you could say that 12.5 chronically over a period of time might also cause such effects. What we're pointing out, what we have proposed as a theory, not only by me, by many other people, is that one possibility for the cause or the etiology of autism is that the vaccine is enough to exceed the threshold of what some children may have, the amount of mercury that some children may have in their brain.
So are you saying today you need 187.5 micrograms?
What about that?
Of ethylmercury. Are you saying that you need the full vaccine?
I'm not saying how much you need. All we're saying is there's a good possibility that that amount of mercury given in vaccines could trigger the cause of autism. But please remember, there is a tremendous variation, as I hope we showed you in the data yesterday. There's a variation, a variability in how children respond to the same amount of vaccine. Some had an 8 times greater, I think, or 5 to 8 times greater amount of mercury in the blood. Others had almost no mercury in the blood at a given time.
If you have so much exposure from methylmercury in utero and postnatally.
I'm not certain you're saying so much exposure. It depends on the person's diet. It depends on the woman, whether a pregnant woman is going to eat tuna steaks. It depends on whether she's going to eat a tuna fish salad sandwich every day for lunch, as they used to do in the past. Most of the women at our university we're not an Ivy League school. Our tuition is among the lowest. We get young women who don't have very much money, and they have to be very careful on what they eat. And when they come to us to begin with, they're usually eating tuna fish sandwiches, of which we recommend they do not. It depends on who the person you're talking about is, what their diet is, as far as how much methylmercury gets into that person.
Well, that's actually my next question then. If there is a high consumption of methylmercury by women, pregnant women, such as in the Seychelles, is there a higher rate of autism in the Seychelles where there's a large fish consumption?
That's a very good question. Because again, as in the Iraqi study, when the Seychelles Island study began, no one even thought about about testing the population for autism. It's my understanding and conversations I've had with Dr. Clarkson that they are looking into that now. But let us also state that the Seychelles Islands may not be an example of what happens in the rest of the world. The Seychelles Islands, their diet, being a tropical country, is very high in citrus fruit. And it has been shown by a superb young woman epidemiologist in Montreal doing a study in Brazil that the diet is important as far as the toxic effects of methylmercury. The women that ate citrus fruit did not have as many toxic signs of methylmercury. So it's a very complex phenomena and a complex question that you're asking.
Now, have you read the report of Dr. Clarkson?
Of who?
Have you read the expert report submitted by respondent of Dr. Clarkson?
Yes, absolutely, I did.
And do you know what he said about autism in the Seychelles? I have a quote for you.
You can quote. I don't have it with me. I do remember.
It's on your screen.
Oh, fine. It's one of the things that I did underline when I read it about a couple of weeks ago.
He says.
So what does he say?
This is a respondent's exhibit K at page 6 and 7. He said, in some 30 years of detailed pediatric and neuron physiological tests on large cohorts of these infants who have continuously elevated mercury blood levels, I have found no evidence of an increased prevalence in autism. Admittedly, we did not specifically look for autistic children, but many of the neurocognitive tests we carried out, none of which uncovered neurological deficits, would surely have detected.
This is unpublished?
Cases.
Is that what you just said?
Pardon me?
Did
I said this is his opinion in his report about finding whether they found autistic signs or symptoms in the Seychelles.
So one could say that the Seychelles Islands population may not be typical of the way people react to methylmercury, because the Faroe Islands say something entirely different. The not only are they genetically different, the seafood they eat, I think most people will agree, are different, and their diet is certainly different. I don't argue with Dr. Clarkson at all. I have great faith in what he says. If he says this, they don't find it in the Seychelles Islands, I have no reason to disagree with that.
Now, I recall from your testimony in Cedillo, you said there's no citrus in the Faroe Islands. Is that correct, from your recollection?
When I visited the Faroe Islands, we had an international meeting on methylmercury there, I think about the year 2000. I don't remember the exact year. To buy an orange there was very unusual. There are almost no trees left on the Faroe Islands. Okay? So I doubt that these people have as much citrus in their diet as they do in the Seychelles Islands.
And do you know whether there's a higher rate of autism in the Faroe Islands?
I have no idea.
Would you be surprised if there wasn't?
I'd have to stop and think about that. It's a very important question, and I just would not like to make a snap judgment like that.
I want to refer now to page 9 of your report.
All thumbs, my apologies. I have page 9 now.
Okay, you have it. You have a comment on the top of page 9 of your expert report that says, referring to the articles authored by Dr. Clarkson and Dr. Magos, that those articles should be viewed, and I'll quote, cautiously, as current scientific investigations may render some of their conclusions false, inaccurate, and outdated. And you were referring to the review articles of Dr. Magos and Dr. Clarkson.
May I make a comment?
Yes.
I would like to apologize to Dr. Magos and Dr. Clarkson. I don't quite understand how that got in. I have a great deal of respect for them. However, times do change. I think both their papers are very deficient in the idea of hypersusceptibility and polymorphism. This is not meant with any disrespect. I hope it does not harm my friendship with Dr. Clarkson, who I have a great deal of admiration for. But their papers tend to be deficient in the genetic aspects of mercury toxicity.
Were you aware, Dr. Poshian, that 47 out of your 54 peer-reviewed articles regarding mercury refer to or rely on reports or articles by Dr. Clarkson or Dr. Magos? About 84% of the articles.
I have a great deal of respect for them. I don't know what your question is, ma'am.
My question is, you don't believe now that they're review articles.
I don't say that.
Our view should be viewed cautiously.
I think all review articles should be viewed cautiously. My review articles that are some of the most quoted ones in the world on arsenic that were recently published, I tell my students they should be viewed cautiously. We have an exercise in graduate school where we give students a paper and say, find out what is wrong with this. We teach our students to be skeptical. No paper is perfect. However, I do want to apologize to Dr. Clarkson and Dr. Magos for this statement that is in here. I meant no offense, and how it got in there is difficult for me to understand. They must be viewed cautiously, as current scientific investigation may render some of their conclusions false, inaccurate, or outdated. I absolutely retract that statement, and I apologize. However, I do think that no review article is perfect, including my own, as well as Clarkson's and Magos's. But no disrespect is intended to these two fine gentlemen and scientists.
Doctor, before this trial started, did you discuss any of the mercury parts of this case with any of the other experts, with any other petitioner's experts? Did you talk to Dr. Kinsborn?
Did I discuss this report?
This report of your testimony yesterday.
Now, can we do it one at a time? Is the
yes.
First question, did I discuss this report with any expert?
Yes.
Yes, I did.
Who did you discuss that your report with?
I discussed this because I needed some help in deciding whether we could make certain assumptions with Professor Dean Cotter of the University of Arizona.
I'm sorry. I'll clarify this. With any experts that are participating in the litigation today?
Absolutely. Not that I can recall. I don't... I'm trying to think what mercury experts you would... our attorneys are fine gentlemen. They know they're mercury. I wouldn't call them scientific experts. I'm thinking about Dr. Dirth, who I know is a superb scientist. I haven't even had a conference with him about this. our neurologist. I just saw her again for the first time since the Sedillo trial yesterday. So I guess the answer to your question is no, I have not discussed this with anyone else that's connected with this trial.
Your testimony yesterday, did you discuss that with any of the experts participating in this
Absolutely
trial today?
Absolutely not.
I'd like to go back to your report now.
Sure.
On page 14 of your report.
I'm on page 14.
Okay. You state that there is increasing evidence for neuroinflammatory events being involved with the development of autism. Is that correct?
That's what it states here.
And you cite Pardo, which is petitioner's master list, 72.
Pardon, you're speaking down to the
I'm desk. Sorry. It's petitioner's master list 72, just to clarify where this is in the record, to make the record. But you quote the Pardo paper. You cite to the Pardo paper, correct?
I didn't hear that. I'm sorry.
The Pardo paper, P-A-R-D-O. Is that what you rely on for your statement?
That's one of them. There are a number of papers from the Zimmerman group, in particular from Hopkins, that are superb papers dealing with neuroinflammatory events involved in the development of autism.
Well, I'd just like to ask you about the article in your report, the Pardo paper.
Can we have that paper since I haven't seen it for a while?
Sure.
Because he has a number of papers on, I want to be certain we're talking about the right one. Thank you. Immunity, Neuroglia, and Neuroinflammation in Autism by Pardo, Vargas, and Zimmerman.
Okay. Did that paper implicate ethylmercury causing the neuroinflammation they report?
This is really a review paper that I haven't read probably for 2 or 3 months. And let's see what their diagram here is. Certainly, if you look at figure 4, you can certainly include ethylmercury in environmental effects.
We hypothesize that
in the conclusions they state, we hypothesize that environmental factors, for example, neurotoxins, which would be mercury compounds, infections, maternal infections, and presence of genetic susceptibility and the immunogenic background of the host influence the development of abnormalities, et cetera, for the generation of autistic symptoms.
And are they referring to vaccines, thimerosal-containing vaccines in that article?
Do they mention vaccines?
Yes. I would
have to read the paper now very carefully. Perhaps if someone has a computer, one might search.
Well, let's assume that they don't.
Pardon?
Let's assume that they don't, okay?
That they don't?
That they do not, yes. How do you tie the neuroinflammation to your belief that thimerosal-containing vaccines cause autism?
My first inclination would be to leave that to our neurologist who will be testifying later on today.
So you have no opinion on that?
I'm not a nurse. I don't have an opinion that I can give you just like that since this is a court of law. I would have to go over the slides that I presented yesterday, which do offer a great deal about neuroinflammation, before I could really make a statement that would be truthful. And so if you want to give me time to go back over these slides, which we have right here.
You gave your testimony yesterday, but without reviewing your slides, you have no cogent opinion to give me at this moment.
I have an opinion, but it's an opinion that I don't want to share with you because I'm not certain that I want to tell the truth. And I'm not positive that if I give you something in a flip, quickly off my mind, that it will be based on scientific fact. We in science are not known for making rapid decisions, where we have very simple minds that have to go in a logical way.
Well, we'll move on. I will not ask you to review your slide presentation.
All right, thank you very much.
I'd like to discuss Pink's disease.
You must notice, however, that we took everything out of the slides. There's hardly any mention of Pink disease in the presentation I made yesterday, number one. Number two, in the Sedillo trial, I mentioned Pink disease as an example of how conservative and reluctant the medical establishment was to declare that the Mercurius mercury or teething powder was its cause. And that is an example of a disease that was stopped by government regulation, not by good scientific cause.
But in Cedillo, we also discussed whether this was a dose-related phenomenon.
Could you talk in the microphone, please? I'm sorry.
In Cedillo, we also discussed, if you recall, whether this was a dose-related phenomenon or an example of hypersusceptibility. Do you recall that?
I recall that, and I recall all the respondents making a big thing of it, and the respondents in this trial, and I was just told to speak to the microphone myself. And I certainly did emphasize the hypersusceptibility during the Cedillo trial, and I probably emphasized it too much. However, I believe scientifically that there was a large element of hypersusceptibility in those children with Pink disease. Unfortunately, I don't think anyone can prove it one way or another because the literature is very deficient about Pink disease during the years that it was a disease affecting our children.
But you would agree that the mercury urine levels taken from children with Pink's disease was elevated?
In some of them, there was a variation. In some of them, there was an elevation.
Which could be a dose response
Which
phenomenon.
Could be a dose response.
On page 8 of your report, and I believe in your testimony yesterday, you discussed porphyrins.
Page 8 of the report, not testimony.
Page 8 of your report, you discussed porphyrins.
Yes, I have page 8.
Do you consider yourself an expert on urinary porphyrins?
Do I think I'm an expert on what?
Urinary porphyrins.
I'm not an expert on urinary porphyrins.
Can a urinary porphyrin profile, specifically the presence of elevated pre-coporphyrin levels, can that be used to diagnose mercury toxicity?
Certainly, the porphyrin profile changes in people who have been exposed to mercury. There is a correlation between the amount of mercury exposure of an individual, especially dentists, but not only dentists, and how the porphyrin urinary profile changes.
Can it be used to diagnose mercury toxicity?
It's used by some people.
Who is it used by?
By a large number of people who, of physicians, who treat autistic children. It also is in the scientific literature, Woods especially, and in most of the new current books, it's cited as a way, as one of the changes that occur when people are exposed to mercury. Now, whether someone wants to use that as a diagnosis or a diagnostic tool or biomarker is, of course, up to the individual physician.
Do you know if it's accepted in the general medical community as a way to diagnose mercury toxicity?
I don't think the general medical community, probably with the exception of one or two medical toxicologists, know anything about heavy metal toxicity. I don't think most medical schools teach anything about about mercury or heavy metal toxicity to medical students, so that when they get out, very few of them know about metal toxicity. And I think that has been a complaint by many organizations, and many national meetings have been held to try to remedy this situation.
So porphyrin profiles can't be found in medical textbooks?
Oh, yes.
Oh, to diagnose mercury toxicity?
Again, what I've stated is it depends on who's making the on what the physician making a diagnosis or treating the patient wants to do. There are certainly places in the world now that you can send a urine to have a porphyrin profile done.
Can you name one or two?
There's one at Paris. I think it's the Institute of, I want to say the Pasteur Institute. I don't know what the institute is, okay. But I can.
That's
I think
fine.
The paper is quoted here. Also,
it's Dr. Nataps.
You can also send it to the University of Washington, Seattle, and Jim Woods will be very glad to do it for you. He's done us, we've published with him, in fact. He has done some for us.
Is it your opinion that the unique porphyrin profiles can be used as a biomarker to diagnose autism due to mercury toxicity?
You're asking me a question that really belongs, should be asked of a physician. I don't do diagnosis. I'm not a physician.
So
I'm a research investigator. I use various tools at my disposal, but I do not diagnose humans. That is a MD's responsibility.
So an elevated porphyrin level, you don't know if that could be used to diagnose autism.
I'm just trying to give you the most truthful answer that I know. I know of people who use it who use urinary porphyrin profiles as a biomarker, as a potential biomarker, one of many biomarkers of questionable use for autism. But that doesn't mean that I approve or disapprove it. I just haven't really, I haven't written a paper on the use of urinary porphyrins as a diagnostic tool. I guess that's the best way of putting it.
Now, you just referred to James Wood in the article that looked at the dentists with chronic exposure to mercury vapor, correct? That's the article you were referring to?
That's one of the papers. There are papers from Paris that showed, I think, that some of the porphyrins were elevated or changed in autistic children.
Can we? We'll go to that. Can we just focus on the Woods article
right now?
Okay. And that was a measure. Those were dentists working with mercury vapor. Is that correct?
The dentists were exposed to mercury vapor, among other things, as a normal individual would be exposed to mercury and methylmercury in the diet, primarily.
And did Woods? He didn't look though to exposure to ethyl mercury, did he?
He does not mention it. Woods does not mention ethyl mercury in his paper. However, I think he may be doing work along those lines at present time. But I know of no paper, and I could be wrong, I know of no paper with Jim Woods' name on it that deals with ethyl mercury.
And he didn't look at an autistic population.
I don't know whether he did or not. I don't know of any paper that he did.
We'll assume that none of the dentists were autistic.
I'm not sure that's a good that's a good assumption. Asperger's, there are some very highly performing people, as you well know, that have Asperger's.
But he didn't identify any of the
he did not identify
as having
any.
Autism. Did Dr. Woods, and you said he extrapolate then, you said he didn't use ethyl mercury or talk about ethyl mercury in any of his papers. So we can conclude that he didn't extrapolate, that his study can be used to demonstrate that thimerosal-containing vaccines can cause mercury toxicity.
I don't think he's been interested at all in the vaccines. I don't know of any paper by Jim Woods that deals with vaccines. Again, I could be wrong, but I don't know of any.
Okay. The second study you refer to is the Nataf study? Dr. Nataf in Paris?
Yes.
Is Nataf important to your opinion about porphyrin profiles?
Again, it would help me if you talked in the microphone. Could you move the microphone over towards you? I'm sorry.
How important to you is the NTAF study, in your opinion?
It shows that autistic children, I think I've forgotten what the number is. I don't have the paper in front of me. They, as I remember, I want to say they probably 120 children. They studied 120 autistic children, I think, and gave them, I think, DMSA also. And if I remember correctly, I haven't read that paper for at least 6 months, but if I remember correctly, the porphyrin profile in the urine went back to normal after they gave the chelating agent to bring the mercury out.
Did that study measure levels of mercury in either urine or blood of the subject?
I haven't read that paper for 6 months, so I'd have to see a copy of it to know what they did.
Would you like to see a copy of that paper?
Thank you. Do porphyrin levels. They did chelation studies. I see nothing in any figures. I don't know about the text, but I see nothing in any of the figures that they followed mercury levels in the urine. But again, I think the implication is that DMSA would bring out lead or mercury in the urine. I don't know, I don't see in the abstract either that urine mercuries were studied, but let's see if in the methods. The impression I have is that they probably did not do urinary mercury levels, but I have not studied the paper closely. That's the impression I have.
Without knowing these levels, the mercury, blood, and urine levels, how does the NTAF study demonstrate an association between mercury toxicity and porphyrin profiles in autistic children?
They studied autistic children. They gave DMSA. All right. DMSA, we know, mobilizes and increases the excretion of mercury. And so it's a supposition on their part that these children, when they were given DMSA, not only had a change in the coporphyrin excretion, but also had a change in mercury. That is an assumption on their part.
The porphyrin studies by Woods and Nataf were renal porphyrins, correct?
Were
renal, urine porphyrins, correct?
Again,
the profiles studied in the Taft in the Woods papers,
yes,
are renal porphyrins, correct?
Urinary
porphyrins.
You said renal.
Urinary porphyrins.
Urinary.
Correct.
That's the problem. I couldn't connect that word with.
Now, Doctor, yesterday, during your direct testimony, Mr. Williams asked you if the urinary profiles was, and I'll quote, semi-quote, I'm not sure, since I don't have the transcript, Mr. Williams asked you if this was one genetic marker to this efflux problem, and you responded yes. And can you explain how a pattern of kidney porphyrins has any relation to a biomarker for mercury efflux?
I would like to know what my direct quote was.
Your direct quote was yes.
Give me the direct quotation in the context that I made it.
I believe you said yes to the question if this was one genetic marker referring to porphyrins, one genetic marker to an efflux problem.
To a efflux problem.
Yes.
Yes, one would expect that if mercury were accumulating in the tissues, that the porphyrin profile would change. Does that answer your question?
Is it a genetic biomarker? for mercury efflux?
It probably would be because of the dentists. It was clearly shown that 15% of the dentists had a different urinary porphyrin profile because of their difference in the way they metabolize the porphyrins.
Do urinary porphyrin profiles tell you anything about the presence of levels of mercury in the brain?
In brain?
Yes.
I don't know.
And on page 8 of your report, you also describe a polymorphism that causes elevated...
Can I get to page 8 first,
sure.
please? Thank you. And what part of page 8 are we dealing with?
Pardon me?
What part of page 8?
The CPOX. CPOX for polymorphism.
Are we talking about the first major paragraph? The urinary porphyrin profile was found 85% of the dentists, but 15 had an atypical porphyrogenic response. Is that what we're talking
yes.
about?
Yes.
And what about that, please?
Are you referring to the CPOX 4 polymorphism?
We are referring to what Jim Woods, I guess, would call the changes in the metabolism of coporphyrins.
Do you know whether that's a CPOX 4 polymorphism?
I don't have the metabolic chart in front of me. And with the long names of porphyrins, coporphyrins, and all, I really would rather have a metabolic chart in front of me so that I can trace the metabolic pathways before
okay.
I come up with a word that...
It's your opinion that there is a genetically susceptible population who, in response to ethylmercury exposure, develop autism, correct?
My thinking that there is a population that, when exposed to the thimerosal of vaccines, will develop, some of them will develop autism.
In the genetically susceptible population that you believe exists, those are the children that cannot excrete mercury? Is that correct?
I would not say they cannot excrete mercury. I would say they cannot excrete mercury, as much mercury as is normal, and as much mercury as they should excrete if they were normal.
And you call this a mercury efflux disorder?
We call it a mercury efflux disorder, similar to the copper efflux disorder known as Wilson's disease.
In this genetically susceptible population, we don't know the rate, whether its efflux is reduced by 50%, 25%, the excretion of mercury. We don't know.
We don't know that because there has not been... enough research yet. The idea of a mercury efflux disorder was first presented at the IOM symposium, which I think was in the year 2004. It takes time to do such experiments.
And does the inability to excrete mercury cause a form of mercury toxicity that results in autism?
Let's go over that sentence very slowly now. Would you please repeat it slowly, section by section?
Does the buildup of mercury, because a child cannot excrete the mercury, does that result in a mercury toxicity that leads to autism?
In my opinion, yes.
And what is the basis for your opinion?
We'd have to go back and look at the basis, number one, the experiments by Holmes and... And Haley being head of chemistry at Kentucky, the experiments by Bradstreet that showed that if you give the DMSA or mercury mobilizing agent, more mercury comes out of these kids as compared to controls. You must mention the Adams study in which baby teeth were used as an indication of the mercury content of the tissues.
And Doctor, I don't mean to interrupt. We'll go over the studies later. I'm not asking the basis for your belief that there is a mercury efflux. We'll get into that later. But does that result in a mercury in a toxicity that causes autism? Is there a toxic?
I think we're talking about the same thing. Or if we're not, I don't understand why we're not. We believe that mercury, I believe that mercury builds up in the tissues, and that mercury level in the brain, because of the metabolism of ethyl mercury to mercuric mercury, is one of the causes of autism. Again, you must realize the autism spectrum disorders are a broad band of diseases. They're all different diseases. Different kids with so-called autism react differently to given therapies. Now, if you're asking me whether I think mercury toxicity in the cells is one of the causes of autism, there's no question in my mind that is one of the causes of autism, and that the addition or the injection of a thimerosal-containing vaccine can be the trigger, making that child go over the threshold of a disease process. Does that answer your question?
I'm not sure. Do you agree with Dr. Deeth and Dr. Mumper that most children with autism suffer from mercury toxicity?
Yes. Well, let's say, science is quantitative. Science is numbers. I would hate in this sense to use an adjective, most. I would say a great many, even that's bad. A certain percentage of children with autism, in my opinion, clearly suffer from mercury toxicity. What that percentage is, I don't know.
Is your genetically susceptible population that you believe exists, are they unable to excrete all forms of mercury, or is it just ethyl mercury?
I really don't know, because that study hasn't been done.
But it's your belief that there's a mercury efflux disorder. Is it a mercury efflux disorder or an ethyl mercury efflux disorder?
There's a mercury efflux disorder that they cannot get mercury out of their cells to any great extent.
So you think it's all mercury, methyl, ethyl?
It can be anything. But the ethyl mercury, we must understand, when it gets into the brain, is deethylated to the very, very toxic mercuric mercury, which when injected directly into the brain, as you pointed out earlier in the slide that you brought up, has very toxic, it causes neuronal necrosis.
Methylmercury demethylates into mercuric mercury in the brain as well, correct?
Pardon?
Methylmercury demethylates into mercuric mercury in the brain as well. Thank you.
But it's it's not demethylated. More of it's excreted. It's excreted or it's removed more rapidly from the brain, so that the amount of mercuric mercury formed from a given dose of methylmercury is less than the percentage is less than the conversion of ethylmercury to mercuric.
Excuse me, did you say methylmercury is excreted faster than ethylmercury?
No, I thought I said, let me reword it to be certain, that methylmercury is removed from the brain faster than ethylmercury is removed from the brain. This is based on the infant monkey studies of Birbacher, where speciation was done and was clearly shown that of the total mercury remaining in the brain, the animals getting ethylmercury had a higher percentage of inorganic or mercuric mercury.
Is mercury efflux a lifelong condition?
We don't know that much about it. We don't know. I guess that's the best way of putting it. We don't know.
And is the only outcome of mercury efflux disorder autism?
Again, as it took them 100 years to show that pink disease was due to mercurous mercury in the teething powder, it's probably going to take the medical community another 50 or 100 years to come to any conclusion about the mercury efflux disorder. And no disrespect is meant to the medical establishment. I think it's clearly accepted that American medical establishment, one of its strengths, actually, is its conservatism.
So with a mercury efflux disorder, you're not removing mercury from the tissues as well as the brain. Is that correct?
Yes, but it's probably a matter of degree, that there's more mercury accumulates in the brain because the mercuric mercury cannot get out of the brain. What the mercuric mercury is bound to also cannot get out of the brain as easily as mercuric mercury gets out of the tissues. The greatest concentration of mercuric mercury in the body usually is in the kidney.
Assuming that mercury efflux disorder is all mercury, and assuming it's a lifelong condition, what mechanism do you know of that would just cause autism without resulting in clinical signs of mercury toxicity?
Well, I think if you talk, I'm not a clinician, as you well know. I'm not an MD, as you asked me many times. I'm not a neurologist, as you well know. But if you talk to many of the physicians who treat and diagnose autistic children, they will say that they see very similar signs they have similar diagnostic evidence for mercury toxicity in some of their autistic children. I'm not a clinician. I don't want to make that statement. I'm telling you what I am told.
Can you reconcile this position with the one you took in 2004? Do you remember you spoke at the 2004 Institute of Medicine, where you said that the signs and symptoms of mercury poisoning are so indefinite and nonspecific that you can come to any conclusions that you want? So is that different than your opinion today? That
can I read this?
Sure.
If 4 years ago, you know, and... there is a term that we've used that I thought we used here called micromercurialism. All right? And it's usually meant to be people who have been exposed to what is normally considered below toxic amounts of mercury, but will have signs, some nonspecific signs, if you will, of mercury toxicity. And the term micromercurialism, I think, is certainly in the literature. And so what should have been said here, and what I am saying is the signs and symptoms of micromercurialism or micromercury poisoning are so indefinite and so nonspecific that you can come to any conclusion you want. And to some extent, that's also true with anything but extremely severe mercury toxicity. Many of the signs of mercury toxicity are signs and symptoms seen in other diseases. That's one reason why a good clinician, I'm sure he'll agree, will want a mercury determination done on the blood and or on the urine before the term mercury intoxication is made. Most of the board-certified clinical toxicologists that I know of would make that statement.
If a person has efflux disorder, the genetically susceptible population has an efflux disorder, can they experience mercury toxicity from eating fish? Too much fish?
Probably. Yes, I would say. They could. Again, depending on how much fish they eat and how old they are and what their genetic predisposition is.
Is there any evidence that such a thing is occurring? Mercury toxicity from fish consumption? Or children with breast nursing? breast milk with methylmercury.
The first question is there any evidence of mercury toxicity from fish eating?
Yes. In this country?
Absolutely. In the Philippines, in Brazil, many of these people, there are huge amount of scientific literature that show that people who eat fish, especially near gold mining, where mercury is used to amalgamate mercury, the mercury gets in the water, the fish consume that water. There are tremendous amount of literature. In fact, that's the Minamata story also, but where in Minamata, these people had the factory dumped mercury into the river. The river emptied into Minamata Bay. The fishermen, the cats, the birds ate this ate these fish, and they got sick. There's no question about that.
There is no question about that, but those were huge doses of methylmercury.
Of course, but you didn't mention huge doses.
I'm saying we have a genetically susceptible population who cannot efflux mercury. They eat tuna fish, cans of tuna fish. Can they suffer mercury toxicity?
Yes, they could. If they were hypersusceptible or if they have a genetic predisposition, they certainly could.
And is there any evidence of mercury toxicity due to a lack of excretion of mercury that results in mercury toxicity from tuna fish consumption?
There certainly is a paper that one of the respondents has criticized from, I think it's the University of California, a physician that's a woman, who showed that many of her patients who were eating high levels of tuna steaks and other things and other high-priced fish had health complaints. And when she recommended that they stop eating fish for 6 months, the complaints disappeared.
And that's
the criticism of these papers is that she did not determine mercury.
And that's the Hightower study, correct?
Thank you very much, the Hightower study.
So we don't know if these people were genetically susceptible because of efflux.
That's correct.
So that paper doesn't demonstrate an efflux disorder.
But you asked me whether I knew of any, I thought you asked me, did I know of any case where eating tuna fish or fish could cause mercury toxicity?
Due to an efflux disorder.
Due to an influx disorder, we have no evidence in those cases that they were influx. They had an efflux disorder.
Now, in your testimony yesterday and in your report, you talk about a spectrum, a band of autism. And I think we can pull it up. It's certainly not as colorful as the one you had yesterday, but we have it on the screen here. Can you identify where on this band children who develop autism from thimerosal-containing vaccines would fall?
We don't know the various kinds of autisms, the various severities of autism have not been quantifiably presented by the medical community. So there is no way that I could fill in the bands between Asperger's, which is high-functioning ASD, or autism, which is the most critical cases where they're severely affected. My point is there is nothing that I know of that we can put in the middle, that I know of. There are probably physicians that could put some things in there, but they would not give us very many bands. That's why it's called the autism spectrum disorder.
Is there any evidence that there is more mercury in the brains of autistic children compared to non-autistic children?
I thought there was a paper that I quoted in my presentation yesterday that showed that autistic children had a high amount of mercury in their brains. And I'd have to go through my... Will you give me a minute to go?
You don't know it off the top of your head?
Pardon?
I mean, You gave your testimony yesterday. You don't recall what article you're referring to.
I think there are 135 or something slides. I certainly could not quote every one of those slides to you.
Would this finding be critical to your opinion?
I don't understand your question.
Is this article critical to your opinion?
It is one of a series of articles that I think is very important, but again, I would like to look at it on my slide set before I made a statement about it, because it has been a very traumatic couple of days, as I'm sure you realize.
I won't have you do that. We'll just move on.
All right.
Is mercury efflux disorder recognized in the general medical community?
I would say I don't know. I do know it's recognized in a large number of physicians who treat autism.
Like Dr. Mumper recognizes? Does Dr. Mumper recognize mercury efflux disorder?
You'll have to ask her.
Okay.
I know that I've been invited to various think tanks that deal with autism that are by invitation only, that have anywhere from 20 to 100 people. And during those talks, people refer to mercury efflux disorder. Based on the evidence that I've pointed out as far as the Adams paper, the Bradstreet paper, and the Holmes paper, and their confirmation by the MIT group.
What think tanks were you invited to? Do you have?
There was one think tank, really very interesting one. There is a small reservation formerly owned by the RCA company that was used for worldwide transmission north of San Francisco, about 45 miles. It's owned by a foundation whose name begins with C, and I just don't remember which one. At that time, they brought about 20 people together. They brought two couples with autistic children. They brought four scientists together, which I was one. They brought some MDs, so it was a small group of people, and mercury efflux. That's one of the meetings that you're asking, think tank. The other think tank is by the Autism Research Institute. That's held about twice a year.
Is that is that a part of Dan?
Dan is part of that group, and it's a very large group. And at meetings, there are probably 6,000 people, not at the think tank, that show up at a Dan meeting, and it's been a tremendous help to the autism community, the community with autistic children, because established medicine for many years would not do anything about treating autism. Autism is now considered by many people to be a recoverable disease by many physicians, certainly not by many establishment physicians, but there are certified cases of recoverable disease. What is sad is that everyone agrees that the more money the parents have or had, the more likely their child was to recover. And that's because the family could spend all sorts of money in trying every single kind of treatment. It's almost undemocratic.
Your hypothesis that thimerosal-containing vaccines, cause autism, is that limited to just clearly regressive autism?
I have not thought about that at all, and I would not want to venture such an important opinion without thinking about it more carefully.
You've never thought about this before?
Your question? No,
yes.
I'm not.
Could you think of a mechanism by which mercury efflux disorder could cause only clearly regressive autism?
Again, I would want to sit and think about it before I made such a statement. I think it still could be an accumulation of mercury at a given time, plus a genetic hypersusceptibility to the mercury. That's about all
that would
safe saying at the present time, because this is a court of law and I must tell the truth.
You testified at CDEO, and in your report, you have it in your report, that there are a hypothesis is that there is a specific window of development that, say, the reason, and I'll your second hypothesis is the reason not all children who receive vaccinations develop autism is because not every child gets vaccinated at exactly the same point in time. Is that your hypothesis?
It is part of my hypothesis to explain why more children don't get it. If you look at the story of thalidomide, which is a known, do you know the thalidomide story?
Yes, I do.
Okay. It is probably one of the worst teratogenic episodes that the human population has been exposed to. But not every child whose mother took thalidomide during her pregnancy got the problem, got the thalidomide, the monster formation. He's born without arms, born without wrists, etc. There is a window for all teratogenic agents, and there's a tremendous amount of literature about this, and that window is usually very narrow, relatively narrow. And so it is very reasonable to me that one of the reasons, not the only reason, that children, that all the children getting thimerosal did not develop autism.
Now, thalidomide was a prenatal exposure, correct?
Thalidomide was a prenatal exposure.
So the window was prenatally?
Yes. But there are other teratogenic agents known that have an effect on the window postnatally.
And what are those?
I think, I'm not positive that valproic acid may be one, but the literature, if you pick up any book, and I'm not even sure about valproic acid being postnatally, but if you pick up toxicology textbook, there's usually a chapter on teratology, and it lists agents that are affected prenatally and postnatally.
And you just listed prenatal ones in your report, for example.
Pardon?
You just listed prenatal exposures in your report, for example.
That's right.
Is the window, does it apply only to a genetically susceptible population, or is it just a timing issue?
I think it's both, but there's no question that in teratology there has to be a predisposition to that effect of the metal. There has to be a predisposition. And so time, and since that predisposition to an agent also has a window, there has to be a time element there also.
And is that predisposition mercury efflux and then the window?
That predisposition would be that the child would be deficient in the mechanism for bringing mercury out of the cell, just as the Wilson's disease patients don't have the gene for the copper transport protein that brings copper out of the cell. We use Wilson's disease or hepatolenticular degeneration, as it's called, as an example of an efflux disorder, which is accepted by the medical community. There's conservative ones also.
But if there's a very narrow window, how is there an accumulation? And so you're accumulating mercury, and then there's a very narrow window?
Be careful. We're not talking about accumulation in that window. We're talking about an effect in that window. In other words, when my arm, and think of me as an embryo, if you will,
I'll try.
The DNA tells my arm to begin developing. Well, the arm just doesn't shoot out. The first thing that happens is a bud is going to occur here, and there's going to be some kind of a hormone or something that will come in and say, hey, make that arm a little longer. And then all of a sudden we have an elbow. And then again, another. So this process can take maybe a week or a month, but each part of it is a window. Are you with me? And so that window can be very narrow. Maybe thalidomide had no effect way here, out here, when my fingernail is formed, but thalidomide may have an effect up here when my shoulder is being formed. So the window window is when some particular morphological event is occurring so that the arm will continue to develop. And that development, if you have a teratogen around, is based on a number of things. It's based on the width of the window, the time element, the concentration of the teratogen, and the predisposition of the mother and the predisposition of the embryo to the toxic effects of that teratogen.
So dose is important, because I thought from your report...
Dose is one of the important factors.
Okay. With autism, are you talking about a neurodevelopmental window?
I'm trying to look at the whole picture of it. There certainly is part of the development of autism as far as a neurodevelopmental window. Which neurodevelopmental window that is, we don't know. If we knew, we would know the cause of autism.
So if I put up William Meade's vaccination schedule, for instance, one of the petitioners in this case, can you tell me where the neurodevelopmental window would be?
You must remember that a child's brain does not stop maturing, does not stop being formed until at least puberty. So to ask anyone what window is going on at this time is almost an impossible question. At each of these times, that child is maturing, that child is developing, his brain is developing. Now, what brain function is developing at 2.5 months of age, or how many brain functions are developing at 2.5 months of age, I would leave that to a neurologist or a developmental neurologist to say.
So you can't tell me what's going on in the brain when that window is open?
I can't tell you because I don't know which window you're talking about. We have
the
many
window,
windows.
The window that when they receive a thimerosal-containing vaccine, it leads to autism, that window.
If we knew that, we could cure autism. We don't know it. No one knows it.
And we don't know what part of the brain the window... We don't know whether it's during the development or part of the brain.
We probably will know it soon because of a paper that Burbacher may have in press, or at least he's about to submit, whereby he's used a technique to not only determine the concentration of mercury in the brain of infant monkeys who got thimerosal, but also is able to localize, visually localize, where the mercury is in various parts of the brain, in certain sections of the brain. That may be a very valuable tool to tell us what's going on. But at the present, we don't know.
Now, you said these windows are very narrow, correct?
It depends on which window you're talking about, and it depends on the definition of narrow. Some are narrow, some are narrower, some are a little... They're not large.
It's your hypothesis, so why don't you tell me? I mean, tell me when the window is, how long it lasts, and how it leads to autism.
It took the thalidomide people almost 4 years to come up with the window for thalidomide. I don't know of anyone that is looking for that window at the present time, because the federal government, the NIH in particular, has been very reluctant to support research on autism. When you stop and think that more money is spent trying to keep a man like me alive, an old man, all right, with research on cancer and high blood pressure, millions are spent by the National Institutes of Health, whereas when I die, it's not going to cost very many people anything. But when a child gets autism, it's going to cost society at least, what was the figure, $3 million or $300 million. And very little money in comparison in this country is spent on research to help the health of children, in particular to find out the cause of autism. And this is where my faith in democracy was restored, because we would not have autism research going on in the National Institutes of Health today if the parents of autistic children did not go to Congressman Burton and a whole series of of congressional hearings were set up and pressure was put on the National Institutes of Health to do autism research. Very difficult for me to say that. I'm a child of the NIH. My complete education and research have been supported by the National Institutes of Health. But it is the one time that I've been ashamed of the National Institutes of Health that they did not support decent research in autism.
I'm going to go back to your windows.
All right.
During this window of vulnerability, is it just mercury that can have an effect on the development of this child, or is it
We don't know, because we don't know what we don't know what window we're really talking about. But usually, windows are susceptible to many agents. Like the thalidomide window has been proposed by some people as being the autism window. But I don't think the medical community accepts that as a whole.
Now, in Cedillo, you said your narrow window was a hypothesis. Has anything come out, any peer-reviewed articles that, is this anything more today than a hypothesis than it was in Cedillo?
A hypothesis as to the mercury efflux, or the hypothesis?
The window of susceptibility.
Window of susceptibility.
The timing issue.
I think I would guess that most clinicians would agree that any kind of a toxin given during the child's development, pre or postnatally, would have a potential window of effect. I don't think any embryologist would disagree with that, and I don't think any pathologist would disagree about that. And as far as medical toxicologists, I would certainly not want to put words in their mouth.
But your window is not for, your window is for 12.5 micrograms or 25.5 micrograms. We're not talking toxic doses during a particular window. We're talking about micrograms. Is that correct?
We're talking about micrograms that are being given to a child who may have large accumulations of mercury in his or her tissues already.
Because of mercury efflux disorder.
Pardon?
Because of mercury efflux.
Because of exposure via the mother, transfer of mercury through the placenta, and because he or she has a efflux disorder.
On page 24 and 25 of your report,
a minute, I have so much paper here.
I'm just going to get a sip of water.
Are you going to show it on here or not?
No, I'm just...
Okay, I have page 24 now. I have page 24.
Okay, Special Masters, I have maybe 35 more minutes of questions. Do you want me to carry on, or... finish it up?
I'd say go ahead.
Okay.
Does anyone need a break at this point? Dr. Apozian, could you use a break?
I would love to have 5 minutes just to collect my thoughts, but I don't need anything more than that. But it's not necessary, Special Master.
Let's go ahead and take our mid-morning break then. We'll resume then at about 10 minutes to 11.